A week after the US president put forward another plan to stop the killing in Gaza and release Israeli hostages taken by Hamas in October, the death toll continues to rise in the besieged and overcrowded coastal strip. Israeli tanks and warplanes blasted central and southern areas of Gaza overnight, killing at least 23 Palestinians, according to local medics. Sources close to the talks being mediated by Qatari and Egyptian officials say there are still no signs of a breakthrough. Greg Karlstrom is Middle East correspondent at The Economist, and he's with us now. Greg Karlstrom, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
This war doesn't appear to be going anywhere soon. All the hope that was there at the end of this time last week with that plan announced, we're no further forward, are we?
No, we're not. And we're in exactly the same dilemma that we've been in for months now with these ceasefire talks. The proposal that President Biden announced last Friday, it was meant to be a three-stage ceasefire. There would be an initial six-week period in which Hamas would release some of its hostages. And then during that six-week period, they would negotiate a more permanent end to the war. And the problem has always been Israel doesn't want to end the war permanently. It's willing to stop fighting for a while to release some hostages, but not for good. And Hamas does want a permanent end to the war. And that seems like, once again, that is the sticking point in these negotiations, as it has been in every prior round of talks for the past 4 or 5 months.
We did hear, it was one line that came out from an Israeli national security advisor before Joe Biden's announcement, that Israel saw this war going on for at least another 7 months. It's hard to envisage a war that, for many, certainly in the Middle East and for Israel, thought this would be a very short war, that it could carry on right up to the end of this year.
I think it's hard even for some Israeli officials to envisage that. I mean, I remember being in Jerusalem back in October, shortly after October 7th, and speaking with Israeli army officers, and they were convinced that they had 2 or 3 months, but the White House was going to pull the plug on this by Christmas. That was the assessment of some people in the Israeli military back in October. Here we are in June, it's still going on, and as you say, military officials and security officials talking about a war that might go until the end of the year, even though it's increasingly unclear what objectives the Israeli army is achieving on the ground. It's been fighting in Rafah for about a month now, hasn't achieved any sort of great battlefield successes in that offensive. And that is the last major area where it has yet to send troops. So not clear what there still is left to do for another half a year in Gaza.
Is the US really the only country, the only people that can stop this war at this stage by their influence on Israel?
It is. I mean, we've heard for many months now from much of the world that they want the war to end. The United Nations General Assembly has repeatedly passed resolutions calling for a permanent ceasefire. We've heard an increasing number of European countries, even close allies of Israel, like France, that have been talking for months about a ceasefire. None of that has amounted to anything. The only country that has practical leverage is the United States, which could, if it wanted to, stop sending arms to Israel, for example, which President Biden sort of threatened to do a month ago before the offensive in Rafah began. He talked about that as a red line and threatened to stop sending offensive weapons to Israel if it went ahead with a big offensive in Rafah. But it's done that, and the Americans have backed off on that threat. And I think unless the administration is really prepared to have a more serious crisis in relations with Israel and a real standoff with the Israelis, they're not going to...
Sorry, Greg. And now the Israeli Prime Minister has been invited to address lawmakers in the US Congress in just over a month's time. It's hard to imagine that he's going to emerge from that without anything but the full backing of both parties fighting in the presidential election this year.
I think he'll certainly emerge with the backing of the Republican Party, which has always been staunchly pro-Netanyahu and continues to be so. I think the speech will be controversial for some Democrats. It already is, the likes of Senator Bernie Sanders and the progressive constituency of the House. There are some left-wing Democrats who I think will find Netanyahu's speech controversial, but it's remarkable to think Chuck Schumer, the leading Democrat in the Senate, 2 months ago gave a speech on the Senate floor calling for Prime Minister Netanyahu to resign, and now he has signed on to this invitation to bring the Prime Minister to speak before Congress. So a very shocking, I think, about face on the part of Senator Schumer.
That's the politics, that's the diplomacy, the reality, of course, of the war in Gaza, as we are seeing, or at least the images that we're seeing without journalists being there, of course, is of a part of the world of which there may be very little left of by the time this war is over.
There already is. The satellite assessments that we have all seen suggest that perhaps 60% of the buildings in Gaza have been either damaged or destroyed in 8 months of fighting. Most people now displaced, living in tent camps. The lucky ones can find tents. The unlucky ones are trying to put together makeshift shelters with whatever pieces of spare material they can find. And no one is talking about reconstruction. I think no one will be talking about it until there is some kind of, you know, more durable post-war security and governance arrangements in place, arrangements that the Israeli government has refused to discuss for 8 months. So I think what's likely to happen is whenever there's a ceasefire, whether it's in the coming weeks or not until later this year, there is going to be a very long period where Gaza does not get rebuilt and people are living in what is essentially the world's largest displacement camp.
Greg, thank you for speaking with us. That's Greg Carlstrom, Middle East correspondent at The Economist, speaking to us from Dubai. Let's go back to the elections here. We heard from some of our correspondents around the country on turnout this lunchtime, voting starting this morning at 7 o'clock, continuing until 10 p.m. Let's check in on Cork, our Southern editor, Pascal Sheehy. Pascal.